Good afternoon. It's 3 o'clock and you are tuned to KTOO News in Juneau here on Monday, the 31st of October, the year 2011. Jeff Brown with you here on a Juneau afternoon. Today on the show, we'll talk to Mike Stanley and Jim Calvin about the master plan for Eagle Crest and how you can take part. Jenny Brady will be here to talk about the upcoming Kinder Music classes. We'll also talk with filmmaker Peter Baxter about the movie Superheroes, playing this week at the Gold Town Nickelodeon. We'll also talk to Ernestine Hayes about her storytelling adventures this Saturday at the Downtown Library at 1 o'clock. Also hear the Writer's Almanac for Note Music and more today on the show. But the forecast for tonight looks like rain, low temperatures around 39 degrees. Forecast for Tuesday, very windy weather with rain heavy at times, southeast winds 15 to 25 miles per hour. Forecast for Wednesday, mostly cloudy skies, and Thursday the forecast is sunny.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Tribal leaders from across the country are focusing on tribal prosperity in Portland, Oregon. They're gathering for the 68th Annual National Congress of American Indians Convention, which kicked off Sunday. A number of initiatives are being launched, including the 2012 Native Vote. NCAI Executive Director Jacqueline Johnson-Peta says the 2012 election is important for Indian country.
We, like many other minority groups across the country, have launched our particular effort, which we call Native Vote. We are encouraging every tribe to have a campaign effort, to have a coordinator, to be able to make sure that we're coordinating and we're engaged, and that we get every tribal member to vote. We really need to be able to make sure that our members of Congress or our state legislators or our, you know, local government know that Indian country cares. We're watching, we're monitoring what they do, and they hear the issues that we want them to take action on.
Johnson-Peta says the Native Vote can make a difference and points to efforts last year by Alaskans Standing Together. The organization, created by Alaska's Native Regional Corporations, encourages voting. Alaska Native people are credited for helping U.S. Alaska Senator Lisa Murkowski win a write-in campaign.
Alaskans Standing Together is a great model for Indian country. I've invited Jerry Mackey to come to our meeting in Portland to share that model and to let tribes across the country see what they can do when they exert their ability to gather together in their nonprofit arenas and their endorsed arenas, and to be able to make sure that they all have a coordination, a message, and they put their efforts forward in a collective way.
The NCAI convention ends Friday. Indigenous people continue to raise concerns about some metallic mines, not just in the U.S., but across North America. The mining industry says it's doing a better job of listening to the criticism. Chuck Kornbach of Wisconsin Public Radio reports.
Prices for some metals are up, so mining companies are active in many countries. But near some foreign mine sites, local indigenous people are raising concerns about pollution and the loss of land. Santos de la Cruz Carrillo is an attorney representing the Huichol people and the Wirikuta Defense Front in Mexico. Speaking through an interpreter at a recent conference of the Society of Environmental Journalists, de la Cruz says a mining company is trying to destroy a sacred site where he lives.
Wirikuta is our sanctuary. It is where all the powerful energies are concentrated, where our ancestors live, where our semi-gods live, and Wirikuta.
The mining industry says in general it's changing and trying to pay more attention to local concerns. Anthony Hodge is president of the International Council on Mining and Metals.
From a company perspective, there's a growing recognition that they cannot proceed effectively without the support of local communities. From a company perspective, there's a growing understanding that the values of the Huicho people, for example, have to play a key role in decision making.
Hodge's group has a good practices guide that Hodge says he's trying to get more companies to adopt. For National Native News, I'm Chuck Kornbach.
During this month in 2010, the Hopi tribe lost its last Hopi co-talker, Rex Puyama. The 93-year-old was one of 10 Hopi co-talkers who served during World War II. This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation. Support for National Native News comes from the National Institutes of Health and National Cancer Institute, dedicated to improving the health of the Native American community. Learn more on how your local community can participate at www.grants.nih.gov. If you are a Native American who experienced discrimination from the USDA while trying to get a farm loan, you can get free legal help with filing a claim at meetings held around the country through December. Details and a schedule of meetings is at IndianFarmClass.com or 1-888-233-5506. Native Voice 1, the Native American Radio Service.
Time is 3:05 and you are tuned to KTOO News in Juneau here on a Juneau afternoon for Halloween Day. In the studio with me is Jim Calvin from McDowell Group and Associates, and also Mike Stanley is on the Board of Directors of EagleCrest here to talk about the EagleCrest Master Plan, which they're having a meeting on Wednesday to talk more about, and they're inviting the public. We're inviting you to listen in on a Juneau afternoon to find out more about it. Jim and Mike, thank you very much for coming down the station today.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jeff.
So first of all, can you give us a little brief history of EagleCrest as a ski area, please?
EagleCrest was developed and opened in the mid-1970s. I'm not sure exactly which year, 74, 75, somewhere in there, as an alternative to the Dan Moore Ski Bowl. And it's just a wonderful resource for the community. A lot of work went into planning it. It's municipally owned, and it's been a very successful little area.
You're in the process of putting together a master plan. What does a master plan do anyway?
It will guide us in decision making. One of the things that we found is that recently there's been different proposals that have been made to the board for different uses at EagleCrest, and we didn't really have a set of criteria for trying to evaluate proposals. So this is a way to help the board make decisions. It's also a way for the community to express its priorities for EagleCrest. What uses would it support? In particular, with the new road up there, which was built a couple of years ago, that has opened up a lot of possibilities, and people have got ideas about what you can and cannot do with the road. And so this is an opportunity to kind of develop a planning document that will hopefully guide our decision making for the next 20 years and inform the public about their ski area.
What kind of steps are involved in putting together a master plan, Jim?
Well, there's really three basic components to this master plan. One is really assessing the market for the kinds of recreational opportunities that are now available and could be available at EagleCrest. And, of course, the market for EagleCrest activities is primarily Juneau residents, but it also includes all of our visitors, the independent visitors, as well as cruise ship visitors. So we need to get a good understanding of what's going on in those two markets and where they might be in 5 years, 10 years, and 20 years. That's the first piece. Another piece is to look at what other ski areas all across the country have done to increase use of local ski areas, particularly in the summertime. We're focusing a great deal on what sort of opportunities might be to get more people enjoying EagleCrest during the summertime. And ski areas all across the country have been focusing on off-season development. So there's lots for us to learn there. And the third piece, and probably the most important piece of this master plan, is to gauge just what it is the residents of Juneau would like to do with EagleCrest, what their vision of EagleCrest is, what's valuable to them about EagleCrest, and what kind of development would be acceptable to Juneauites. That, the owners of EagleCrest are Juneau residents. We really need to understand what they would like EagleCrest to look like in 5 years, and in 10 years, and ultimately in 20 years. So public involvement, public participation, public input is really a critical part of this master planning process.
Who's working on it?
Well, we have McDowell Group is the lead contract firm. We're a research and consulting firm that's based here in Juneau. We also have an office in Anchorage. We've done a fair bit of work for EagleCrest over the years, primarily survey research, local household surveys and user surveys, as well as some market assessments for property development up there. We're joined on this project by a company called SE Group, which is a national, in fact, internationally known ski area planning group. And this company, they're the ones that keep track of what's going on elsewhere in the country, and they can really bring some valuable lessons to the table on what's worked elsewhere, what hasn't worked, and what some of our opportunities might be here in Juneau. We also have Jan Caulfield, joining us as our public involvement specialist. She'll be leading the public meeting on Thursday as our facilitator, and she's helping with all aspects of the public involvement process. She's also a Juno person.
Mm-hmm. And so the public meeting is Wednesday or Thursday?
It's Wednesday at 7 o'clock in Centennial Hall.
And you've also been doing some phone surveys. What kind of things have you been finding out through the phone survey?
Well, we conducted a telephone survey of 450 randomly selected households. Conducted the survey in the very latter part of September, early October. And the reason to do this kind of a survey is that this is the only public outreach tool that we're using that generates data that's statistically representative of the entire community. We're also doing an online survey, and so far we have about 600 responses to the online survey. Very happy with the response to that. Also have opportunities on the SkiJuno.com website for people to submit their thoughts on what they would like to see happening with Eagle Crest. We're right in the middle of analyzing all of our detailed findings from the telephone survey, and we'll be presenting those in some detail Wednesday night. But, I think it's what we'll see is it's, no easy answers here. We've asked some difficult questions about commercial use of the ski area, summer and winter. We've asked questions about motorized use of the ski area. We've asked questions about beer and wine sales, and I think what we're seeing is that there's no general consensus in the community about some of these important issues, but we'll have more details on that here Wednesday evening.
How far ahead do you look for the master plan?
Well, the plan itself is a 20-year document, so we're trying to learn lessons from the 1980 master plan, which was another long-term plan that actually suggested that by now we'd have about 50,000 residents in Juneau. So it had great ambitions for the master plan. We're trying to be a little bit more realistic about where we might be in 5 years or 10 years as a community in terms of our population. But we want to develop a document that's useful not just now, but in the future. And as Mike said, a key part of this plan is to identify criteria with which the board of directors can use to just decide what is a compatible use of Eagle Crest and what's not a compatible use.
What do you think? Go ahead, Mike.
I was going to say, as far as the process, the plan, I think our current trajectory or the schedule is to have the plan finalized in April of 2012 and then take it to the Assembly. So this public meeting is actually, November 2nd, is key because this is going to be the one real big public meeting where the public can, members of the public can come to the meeting, kind of see what the issues are, get an idea of what the range of uses that might be considered, maybe find out why certain other uses are not really feasible. So this is going to be a very important meeting, and we really encourage the public to attend, not just skiers, but anybody who is interested in Eagle Crest and what Eagle Crest does for the community should come and weigh in.
That's a really important point, Mike. Our survey research is intended for all Junoites, not just users of Eagle Crest. So we have good feedback from people who aren't users as well about what some of the priorities ought to be. But going forward, we have an online survey up and running and available for people to take now, and that'll be available through the end of this month, the end of November. And then after that, we've got some work to do actually writing the master plan document itself. We hope to be back in front of the board of directors and the public in February, and at that time expect to have another public meeting when we'll present the draft master plan, and as Mike says, hope to present something to the Assembly along about April.
And how can people find the questionnaire online?
Go to skijuno.com, and there's a link right there that'll take you right to the survey.
But how long do you think it would take an average user?
It depends on how much additional information you might like to add, and certainly we're encouraging people to reach outside the boundaries of the survey itself and tell us what they think ought to happen up there. But, it's really a 10-minute survey if you take your time at it.
I'm talking with Mike Stanley and Jim Calvin about the Eagle Crest Master Plan meeting, which is going on this Wednesday from 7 o'clock to 9:30 at Centennial Hall. What's the schedule for the meeting?
We'll start promptly at 7 o'clock with a presentation. We ourselves and SC Group will present some of our preliminary findings, some of the market assessment, as well as some of the telephone survey research results. We'll probably be presenting for about 45 minutes. Now, we'll also have quite a number of display boards with information communicating a wide range of information, such as what other ski areas have done for summertime development and the scope and schedule for this master planning effort. And we have some pretty fun maps showing what some of the possible trails might be for summertime development up there. We're looking at all manner of development, from lodging to mountain biking trails, hiking trails, night skiing, further night skiing development, a hut-to-hut system. We're really trying to keep all of our options open in terms of what we consider in this master plan. And so what we want to do on Wednesday is get people to be thinking about these things and offer their perspective on whether these are the kinds of things that are really compatible with Eagle Crest and what they would like to see up there.
So the phone survey is also on the online surveys you've seen already. The only clear consensus is there's no clear consensus.
That's about right. Like I say, we're early in the analysis phase with the data. In fact, just got it last week, so looking at it. But I think what we'll see that will be very interesting is that the Skiri users have a little bit different ideas about what ought to happen up there, what's acceptable, and what some of the priorities ought to be in terms of Skiri development. I think they have a little different priorities than non-users, so it'll be very interesting to look at that. And, of course, we have to keep in mind that the interests of non-users are very important as well. After all, the city does help support Eagle Crest, and a big objective of this is to get even more people up at Eagle Crest. So we want to talk with, we want to hear from, and learn from non-users who might be more interested in being up there in the summertime and doing hiking and biking and those kinds of things. So it's really important that we hear from everyone on this process.
And then when it's released next April, I guess you say next year, given to the Assembly, what's the path of action then?
Well, once we have the planning document, then it will be there, and hopefully we'll refer to it and use it. One of the things that's, I think, going to be very useful about it is it'll give the general manager of the ski area a document to which he can refer. The new manager is Matt Lillard. He's just arrived in town, so he'll be starting shortly. But if somebody comes to him with a proposal, he'll be able to look at the master plan and say, well, yeah, this might fly, or, that really probably is not going to fly because of these criteria. So it'll really help the general manager in responding to the public. So that's what it will be. It'll serve as a functional working document.
Mm-hmm.
And, I would just want to emphasize one other point. What we are also looking at is are there new revenue-generating activities that we can find up there? So we're looking at this range of activities, but one of the questions that's being considered is, are there revenue-generating activities that can be developed up there to assist in Eagle Crest paying its way?
I've been talking to Mike Stanley and Jim Calvin about the Eagle Crest Master Plan, which is there is a public meeting this Wednesday from 7 to 9:30 at Centennial Hall. People have more information about, if you need more information about that, you can check their website at www.skijuno.com. Anything you'd like to add, I might have forgotten to ask?
No. Thank you, Jeff. I want to reiterate that take the online survey. We really want to hear from folks. That's available until the end of November. That's at skijuno.com, and we hope to see everyone Wednesday evening, 7 o'clock at Centennial Hall, to learn more and talk with us about the master plan.
All right, thanks for coming by.
Thank you, Jeff.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Monday. It's the 31st of October, 2011, Halloween, All Hallows Eve, the time of the wandering dead, and people going door to door, begging for candy. If you were looking for a scary story to read out loud, you could always go to Washington Irving's The Legend of Sleepy Hollow. The superstitious schoolmaster, Ichabod Crane, who was chased through the roads at midnight by the ghost of a Hessian soldier whose head has been blown off by a cannonball. Or you could look at Nathaniel Hawthorne's story, Young Goodman Brown, set in Salem during the witch trials. A young Puritan newlywed sets out at sunset on an errand through the woods, leaving his new bride, whose name is Faith, behind. Into the heart of the wilderness he goes and meets a mysterious man who leads him to a witch's Sabbath, where what looks like his wife, Faith, and the rest of his neighbors are engaged in witchcraft. The next day, He's back home, but he never loses his suspicion of his wife and neighbors. He has no sense of community left, and he lives in fear and suspicion to the end of his days. Or you could look at Mark Twain's story entitled A Ghost Story, which summons up the Cardiff Giant, one of the most famous hoaxes in American history, the likeness of a 10-foot man carved out of a block of gypsum exhibited in New York City. The Lincoln Highway was dedicated on this day, 1913, first automobile road across the entire continent, gravel road from Times Square in New York to Lincoln Park in San Francisco. It's the birthday of John Keats, born London, 1795, discovered literature as a teenager, devoted himself to poetry. In 1818, he took care of his brother, dying of tuberculosis, and Keats contracted the disease himself, died in Rome, 1821, at the age of 25. And it's the birthday of the journalist Susan Arlian, born Cleveland, 1955, author of The Orchid Thief and her most recent book, Rin Tin Tin, The Life and the Legend. Here's a poem for today by Henry Wadsworth Longfellow, Haunted Houses. All houses wherein men have lived and died are haunted houses. Through the open doors the harmless phantoms on their errands glide, with feet that make no sound upon the floors. We meet them at the doorway, on the stair, along the passages they come and go, impalpable impressions on the air, a sense of something moving to and fro. There are more guests at table than the hosts invited. The illuminated hall is thronged with quiet, inoffensive ghosts, as silent as the pictures on the wall. The stranger at my fireside cannot see the forms I see, nor hear the sounds I hear. He but perceives what is, while unto me all that has been is visible and clear. So from the world of spirits there descends a bridge of light, connecting it with this, o'er whose unsteady floor that sways and bends wander our thoughts above the dark abyss. From Henry Wadsworth Longfellow's poem, Haunted Houses. That's the Writer's Almanac, supported by Constant Contact, combining the power of email marketing and social media for more customers and more time back on your clock. ConstantContact.com. And by PBS, presenting The Fabric of the Cosmos, a new Nova series with physicist and author Brian Greene. Starts Wednesday, 9, 8 Central on PBS. Produced by Kathy Roach, written by Holly Vanderhaar. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
Programming is supported in part by McDonald's, now serving the McRib sandwich. McDonald's, open daily on Trout Street in the Valley.
Time is 3:23 and you are tuned to KTOO News in Juneau here on a Juneau afternoon. Our next guest is Jenny Burdine, who is new in town, and she's teaching a kinder music class starting on pretty much as we speak. Jenny, thank you very much for coming to Juneau here today.
Thank you.
So first of all, for people who don't know, what is kinder music?
Kinder music's a music and movement class, and the classes I teach are for babies, toddlers, and preschool-age children. And it's more than just music, because we do movement and dance, and we do the instruments, we do stories, and it's just really is a class that nurtures the children's development, and it's fun, and they get to play music and sing together.
How is it presented to young children?
It depends on the age. If for the babies, I have a class that's for newborns to 18 months, and that's really the parents doing most of it and just giving the parents ideas of activities to do at home and different songs they can sing to their children and different ways to bond with their children through music. And then for the older children, they take a more active role, and they're playing the instruments, and they're doing the dances and singing and listening to the stories.
How does it differ from other methods?
I think it differs from other methods in that it's really specific for each age group, because they are so focused in, like there's a class for 2 to 4 and there's a class for ages 3 to 5. So they really take those, what those children are going through developmentally, and design the class specifically for them.
What instruments do you use?
A lot of different instruments, and that also depends on the age group, because we have, for the babies, specific ones that are easy for the babies to hold and grab and move around with. And then as they get older, a little more advanced, where they're using two hands and having to work those fine motor skills to play the instrument. So we have like sand blocks and rhythm sticks and shakers and drums and tambourines and all sorts of things.
What's the objective? Is it to have fun learning to play music, or is it to put up professional musicians?
Definitely to have fun. It's definitely about process, not performance. Definitely to, and also our philosophy is that the parents are the best teachers, so they have these materials, they get to take home with them, a CD and a book and an instrument. So it's really all about what the parents get to do with the children at home, so they continue that music making and having fun at home together.
Do the parents attend the classes at the same time as the kids do?
They do. For the ages I'm teaching, they do. It's a really great time to bond with your child, and it's also great for socialization for the kids and the parents.
How did you become interested?
Well, I've been a music teacher, an elementary music teacher, for 6 years back in Maine, and I moved here, and I have a 2.5-year-old daughter, and I was looking into music classes, and there wasn't anything here for her age, and I kind of stumbled upon Kinder Music, and I said, well, that sounds like fun. I'd like to do that, so I became licensed.
What does it take to become licensed?
You take a series of classes online, and you have a mentor, and you have to go through all these classes and webinars and take quizzes and all that, and then you teach a practicum. So I get to teach a bunch of my friends' children a little practice class, a 4-week practice class, and then if everything goes well, you become licensed.
And the class schedule and costs?
The schedule right now, I'm teaching the newborn to 18-month class is called Village, and we meet on Mondays at 10 and on Thursdays at 5:30 p.m. And the cost for that is $119 for, it's an 8-week class. And that's going on right now, but people can enroll and just pay for the remainder of the classes if they're interested. The other class I'm teaching is called ABC Music and Me, and that's for 2 to 4-year-olds. And that class meets on Wednesdays at 11 a.m. and on Wednesday evenings at 5:30 p.m. That one's $50, and it's a 4-week class. And I'm also starting a whole new semester in January with all new classes. And can I give my website so
please,
people
please,
can check
yeah.
that out? So if you are interested, check out www.kindermusicwithjenny.wordpress.com. And music is spelled with a K on the end.
All right, and these classes are held at the Juno Family Health and Birth Center?
Yes, they are.
Do you want to give out your phone number in case people want to get a hold of you?
That would be great, thanks. I still have my main phone number, so it's 207-607-9939.
All right, Jenny Burdine, thank you for coming by and talking about the Kinder Music classes, which are starting as we speak. Anything you'd like to add I might have forgotten to ask?
I think that's it. Thank you for having me.
Have you heard a jazzy cat like that? Give me the sounds of jazz and all that pizzazz. Oh, scat like that. Your voice can chat like that. Take it away, whatever you say when you scat like that. Syllables and consonants with rhythm and design. Your voice becomes an instrument. See if you can follow mine. Ba beep ba da doo dee da doo da.
Ba beep ba da doo dee da doo da.
Zoo za zoo zee zee zoo zee 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 za.
Zoo za zoo zee zee zoo zee 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 za.
everyone knows that. But one fact that was never told, that lamb could really scat. Bah, wee doo doo wah.
Bah, wee doo doo wah.
Ooby dooby doo wah, be doo wah wah.
Ooby dooby doo wah, be doo wah wah.
Shooby dooby doo, me me ma me moo moo.
Shooby dooby doo, me me ma me moo moo.
Scat like that.
Scat like that.
Queens have scattered with the masters of the voice, but you're the subject of this song. The alphabet's your choice. Cat like that. Have you heard a jazzy cat like that? Give me the sounds of jazz and all that pizzazz. Oh, scat like that. Your voice can chat like that. Take it away, whatever you say when you scat like that.
It's 3:31 and you are tuned to KTUO News in Juneau here on a Juneau afternoon. This week at the Cool Time Nickelodeon, there's going to be an interesting film shown. It's called Superheroes. In the studio with me to talk about it is Colette Costa.
Hello, Jeff.
And talking to me via telephone from Los Angeles is Peter Baxter, one of the filmmakers involved. Peter, thank you for being on the show with me today.
Thank you.
So first of all, Peter, you're associated with a group called Slam Dance. Could you talk about Slam Dance, please?
Yes, Slam Dance is an organization for emerging independent filmmakers, and we've been around since 1995 when a bunch of us got rejected by Sundance with our low-budget features that didn't have any distribution. And we quickly realized that we're going to be lots of other filmmakers coming on behind us that also wanted a platform, a support system, which they otherwise weren't getting, and so we decided to really focus then on supporting emerging filmmakers after we showed our own films, and that's what we've been doing ever since 95, and Superheroes was one of the films that we premiered at this year's festival in Park City, Utah.
So your film festival happens concurrently as the Sundance Film Festival?
Yeah, we do, and I think that when we first started, a lot of people in the industry and a lot of people at Sundance thought that it was a case of, well, there goes the neighborhood. But really, as we have grown over the years, I think that if you put Sundance and Slam Dance side by side, they really actually complement the spirit and what U.S. independent filmmaking has to offer. With us, you very much get the beginning, the emerging filmmakers coming through. And I think that at Sundance, you also, get these great independently made films, but films which, really have already got distribution deals and have got bigger stars and known directors already involved with them. But if you put those two together, it makes for an amazing American showcase.
I went to a movie the other day at the Golden Nickelodeon, and I saw the trailer for Superheroes, which is very intriguing. Could you tell me about the movie, please?
Yeah, well, in many ways, it's a bit like Sundance, the underdog, the group that's trying to, come through and do some good for our community. And with Superheroes, it's to do with, your local community and people that need help. And the documentary shows at the beginning, really, how, an odd-looking group of superheroes who are perhaps, a little comical that we may laugh at, actually, in the end, are really trying very hard and are doing good for our community. And there's questions that come out of that you have actually in terms of how our society takes care of its people through regular law enforcement. And you actually get, in the end, a very positive, I think, outlook from these real life superheroes who dress in all kinds of homemade, funny, odd, peculiar costumes that go about usually in nighttime, protecting the people or trying to protect the people around them.
Do they think of themselves as odd?
some do, but then, of course, don't we all from time to time? And, of course, they, you know, what they do, though, is that for the most part, they actually really put that idea at the front of our minds, and they question our human behavior. But they're good people. That's at their heart, and they're trying to do good things.
And these are superheroes. What are their powers exactly?
Well, they've all got various powers, of course, as every superhero has. But there are some that perhaps are more funny than others. But there is the Brooklyn contingency that takes themselves actually quite seriously, but actually do very good work in the neighborhood. Obviously, there is a shortage of law enforcement in this area of Brooklyn, and they really are trying to, without competition, just to support what is really needed, they feel anyway, in their community of helping helping to protect people.
How many superheroes did you profile?
Well, there are quite a few profiled in the superheroes. I'll give you some of the cast, if you like, the names of the cast, and it will give you some sense of, where we're at. Mr. Extreme, Master Legend, Thanatos, Zetterman, Life, Dark Guardian, the New York Initiative, and they're supported, by the way, by Stan Lee, who acts as a kind of a Greek chorus, if you like, is commenting on the real-life superheroes and, of course, the superheroes that he's also created. And gives us an interesting cross reference throughout the film. But these superheroes are from all across the United States, and they show actually an example of the increasing subculture, if you like, that's growing in the United States of real life superheroes.
How did you find these people? Did you try to commit a crime and they found you and? How did it?
Well, the director of the film, Michael Barnett, first found Mr. Extreme, and there's all kinds of individual superhero stories on the web. But what he did is that he met and interviewed a number of them, chose a cast of characters that he felt would be able to create a documentary. Created a very successful one. It won a prize at Sundance. And what we're doing with the film, and we're really excited that it's showing in your community, is we're taking it out on the road as a tour, really, around the United States to 12 different locations.
Colette Costa from the Gold Line Nickelodeon is also in the studio with us here today. Colette, thank you for coming in.
Thank you, Jeff.
So why did you pick Slam Superheroes?
Well, they contacted me, and which is always a big plus for us. But they sent me, an early screener to check out, and I just really felt like on top of being a really interesting subject matter and a well-made film, I really thought the content fit in with our community. You know, at best, I kind of feel like Alaska and Southeast Alaska tends to be, it can be a bit of a island of misfit toys in its own little way, and and these people were, the people profiled in the film, sort of, they were very familiar to me. You know, the idea of being a little bit odd, having some curious interests, and, you know, and yet being accepted within their community by being themselves, but adding to the value of their community. And I really felt like that, you know, that spoke to me into sort of a small town Alaskan way.
Peter, how did these people find the way to convert into their superheroes since with the demise of the telephone booth?
I'm sorry, I didn't quite... The telephone the booth, Jeff, I'm sorry, you cut out there a little bit.
Well, now that there aren't anything like telephone booths, how do they change into their costumes?
Well, of course, they snap their fingers and they're into their new... They're into their costumes straight away. Well, they do it a little bit more... they do it quite like us. They would change in their cars or in their vans or in their house.
Their vans.
But what they do, all of them, actually, except for the New York Initiative, the superheroes from Brooklyn, they really do keep their normal life private. So it's interesting because you have a cross-section of professionals in daily life. There are teachers, there are writers involved in as real-life superheroes. But they do like to keep that that private. In the Q&A that we had at Slamdance, we had a local superhero actually from Salt Lake, and he really didn't want, he kept his costume on all the time because he really didn't want the audience to recognize him because he was a local teacher in Salt Lake, and he felt that, you know, if they found out, they might make fun of him or take him less seriously as a teacher.
What kind of things do the law enforcement community think of the superheroes?
Well, in the documentary, there was actually a fair amount of criticism shown toward the superheroes in the documentary. But there's some very important questions that are being raised by the filmmakers and by the superheroes, and really ultimately actually by law enforcement, because they have to admit that they are short on law enforcement officers many times. And you also get to understand how hard it must be to be a law enforcer. And it just doesn't seem to be an infrastructure, a big enough infrastructure in place to really take care of many of our communities in the United States. And so superheroes, as frustrating as they may be for many of the law enforcement officers that we see in the film, are then providing something, at the very least, something to help protect, or try to protect our community, which is appreciated.
Peter, what kind of lessons in life can we learn from superheroes?
Well, I think that, you know, at this time, I think that it actually shows up how important our communities are, wherever we may come from, whether we come from a village, market town, a city, how staying close with one another and working together as a community really can help for a better existence. And I think that is something that the Superheroes documentary really shows. And I think it's something that in many ways looks as though that is lacking in many of the areas that we live that we live in the United States. And we'd do well to work on that harder in the future to make stronger communities.
Peter, what other kinds of films from Slamdance should people be on the lookout for?
Well, there's some very well-known ones. Perhaps the most popular one is Paranormal Activity. We premiered Paranormal Activity, and out of the festival it was purchased. It was a film that was made for $10,000, and it went on to create, basically a global multi-million-dollar enterprise for the filmmakers and the company that now owns the rights. That's one example. But like superheroes, there are many great films at Slamdance that are made from the heart. They're passion projects. They're a unique filmmaking that may not become, you know, commercial blockbusters like Paranormal Activity, but have a very strong point of view and have something to entertain us. And also with superheroes, you know, a great opportunity to help inform and educate us, really.
All right, Peter Baxter, thank you for talking about Slamdance and also the film Superheroes at the Gold Town Nickelodeon happening this Tuesday and Wednesday at 8 o'clock. Glenn, anything you'd like to add, or Peter, anything you'd like to add that might have forgotten to ask?
No, just many thanks for including Slamdance and Superheroes on your radio show. We really appreciate it. And it's really important to us that we bring films out to places all over the States. I'm just very happy, Colette, that you're programming the film, and wish you the very best of it. Wish we could be there.
Yeah, thanks, Peter. Appreciate it. And I'd also like to say we have, in addition to Superheroes, on Tuesday at 6 p.m., the Occupy Juno group is doing a donation-based showing of Inside Job at 6 p.m., if you'd like to come down to see that, before Superheroes. And then on Wednesday, also before Superheroes at 6 p.m., the Slow Foods group here in Southeast Alaska is sponsoring a new documentary called Ingredients, and it's going to be a community potluck at 6 o'clock, and the movie is at 6:30. If you'd like to come down to that, and those are regular ticket prices for that one, unless you would like to bring a donation of non-perishable foods for the food bank, and then you'll get a discounted ticket. And again, Superheroes, 8 p.m., on Tuesday and Wednesday. And Peter, thank you for being here. Appreciate it.
Thanks.
Okay, so you know what what you have to sing. This is really easy, nothing to it. All you have to do is whatever I do right after me. Here we go. My mom says she's a super mom, but I don't think that's true. She washes the windows all day long, but I can do that too. Now just get the windows washing with one hand, just your right hand washing the windows. It's no big deal to being a super mom. My mom says she's a super mom, but I don't think that's true. She works the computer and the telephone, but I can do that too. Get the computer and the telephone going with your left hand. Keep the windows washing with your right hand, and I'll show you just how easy it is. My mom says she's a super mom, but I don't think that's true. She bounces the baby on her hips, but I can do that too. Now you've got to keep the baby bouncing on your hips, otherwise it'll wake up. But the computer is going, uh-oh, there's a telephone. Don't forget that window over there. My mom says she's a super mom, but I don't think that's true. She minds the kids and the dogs and the cats, but I can do that too. Just mind the kids and the dogs and the cats with your head, okay? Keep the baby bouncing on your hips. The telephone is going, look out, here comes the window. My mom says she's a super mom, but I don't think that's true. She jogs to the office every day, but I can do that too. She's jogging to the office. Oh, the baby's waking up. Look out, oh, there's another window. My mom says she's a super mom.
You're tuned to KTOO News in Juneau, and I'm on the air with Ernestine Hayes, who will be doing a reading of her story, The Town Bear and the Forest Bear, this Saturday at 1 o'clock at the Downtown Library. Ernestine, thank you very much for being on the air with us today.
It's my pleasure, Jeff. Thank you.
So this is a unique book. You want to tell us how unique it is?
Well, it's the first book that has been published first in the Tlingit language. It was originally a children's story that I used to tell when I worked on the Alaska State Ferries. And Liz Dodd, local editor and writer, decided that she would like to publish it. And with the help of the AASB, we published it first in the Tlingit language.
What was the translation process like?
It was very difficult, but I have to say Liz did most of it. She took the English copy and she arranged with some Tlingit speakers in Sitka to translate the English into Tlingit. And then she took the Tlingit version that they had produced and gave it to Tlingit speaker here in Juneau and asked her to translate that back into English just to make sure that the integrity of the meaning remained the same. And it was a wonderful process that ended up with a wonderful book.
I hate to take away the surprise at all, but could you give us the basic plot of the book, please?
It's based on the children's story of the Country Mouse and City Mouse, and it's adapted for our local Alaska, Southeast Alaska living environment, and it's about a town bear who goes to visit his relative in the forest, and his relative in the forest shows him all the places where he goes to obtain food. He has to dig roots and climb on hills and stand there for a long time in the cold water waiting for a fish. And the town bear says, "This is too much work. Come back to town with me where there's special food that they put in special cans just for me." And from there it goes on and they get in more trouble than they expect.
I guess one of the things that made the translation hard was that there's no traditional Tlingit words for automobile and car and other things like that.
That's right. And another difficult concept was bird feeder, but there was no trouble with peanut butter because it turns out that the Tlingit word for peanut butter is peanut butter.
What age is this appropriate for?
Well, it's for any age, and in fact, the person who's going to be reading the book in the Tlingit language uses it for her Tlingit language class here at the college. So it's for any age of anyone who wants to practice their Tlingit language skills, read it to their children, anybody who's learning the language, or just for fun.
Will it be read in English or just Tlingit?
It's going to be read in Tlingit and then also in English by Marcia Hodge's students. It was a lot of fun having it edited and seeing it being used by adults, children, and students. We're also having, Marcia's also doing a reading tomorrow night at the university here with the same students. So it's just wonderful to see it being in use around Juneau.
Will the book be for sale at the library this Friday, this Saturday at 1 o'clock?
Yes, I believe so.
Sounds good. Where else is it available?
It's available at Hearthside Books, and it's available on online at Hazy Island Books, and the Alaska Association of School Boards has the Tlingit version available, and in fact, they provided the Tlingit version free of charge to many of the schools around Southeast Alaska. I hope everybody comes, and one of the things that we hope to spend some time on is the study guide that we have, because it promotes a lot of the values that go across cultures and just about living in Alaska with our relatives, the Bears.
Very interesting. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Jeff.
I went to his room in the middle of the night. I tiptoed inside and I turned on the light, but to my dismay, he was nowhere in sight. And I'm sure Uncle Walter went waltzing that night. He goes wah 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 wah. A new suit to wear, but when he comes in, it's all covered with hair. And lately I've noticed there's several new tears. And I'm sure Uncle Walter's been waltzing with bears. He goes wah 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 wah, waltzing with bears. Raggy bears, shaggy bears, baggy bears too. And there's nothing on earth Uncle Walter won't do. Bear. hug with nary a care. It all feels like flying, there is no denying, and now my pajamas are covered with hair. We go wah 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 waltzing with bears, Raggy Bear, Shaggy Bear, Saggy Bear too, and there's nothing on earth Uncle Walter won't do.
This is Bird Note. Imagine yourself an 18th century sailor setting foot on a remote Pacific island on Halloween evening. You've rowed to the island to find fresh water for the ship, only to be greeted by this frightful moaning. Some early sailors feared that this ungodly wailing meant they had been tricked ashore at the gates of hell itself, when in truth they stood shuddering among courting pairs of seabirds called wedge-tailed shearwaters. Dark, gull-sized seabirds with long, thin, tapering wings, wedge-tailed shearwaters nest on islands in the tropical Pacific and Indian Oceans, from Hawaii to Western Australia to Madagascar. From dusk to midnight during courtship, pairs of wedge-tailed shearwaters sit facing one another on the ground and puff up their throats to perform long duets of eerie wailing, sometimes sending spooked sailors rowing in panic back to their ship for a ration of grog. Treat yourself to a look at a wedge-tailed shearwater when you come to our website, birdnote.org.
And you are tuned to KTOO News in Juneau. We broadcast at 104.3 FM in downtown Juneau and Douglas. KTOO also broadcasts on these translators. In the Valley and Ock Bay area, tuned to K276 AF at 103.1. In Lemon and Switzer Creek, K269 AO at 101.7. Gustavus listens on K201 AM 88.1. K220 BT Sarasuna at 91.9. Excursion Inlet and Icy Strait, you can hear KTOO on K210 AS 89.9. And in Juneau, you can also receive KTUO on GCI Cable Juneau on digital channel 871. We're also online at www.ktuo.org. Tomorrow at 3 on a Juneau afternoon, Pat Moore will host. He'll talk with Scott Carley about his recent Museums Alaska Award, learn about hospice, the law, and end-of-life issues with Vance Sanders. Dave McKenna, Juneau Douglas High School varsity hockey coach, will be here to spotlight the season. And we'll find out about the school district's energy conservation program with guest Adrian Schwartz. At Writer's Almanac, Bird Note Music, and more tomorrow at 3 on a Juneau afternoon. There's a strong wind warning from the Tuesday morning through Tuesday afternoon predicted. Tonight, forecast for rain, high, low temperatures around 38 degrees. Forecast for Tuesday, very windy weather and rain, possibly heavy at times with high temperatures around 44 degrees. Forecast for Tuesday night, rain in the evening, then a chance of rain and snow later on. Wednesday, mostly cloudy skies, and looks like Thursday, from sunny skies to partly cloudy skies with high temperatures around 34 degrees. And then next is All Things Considered. Thank you for tuning in to Junior Afternoon today, and have a great evening.